the topic is deliberately a little contradictory, because when you think of relationships, it's not something that's got entrepreneurial language in it, like currency. Currency is something material, and relationships that are very satisfying, they're not like that. So, deliberately, currency of relationships, you'll see as we unfold, because there are different categories of relationships, and one way to look at relationships is pure and impure. The presentation itself, for those of you that are devotees, this is Rupa Goswami presented to people that don't know Rupa Goswami. That's where we're going. And for those of you that don't know Rupa Goswami, it's currency of relationships. Here's Rupa Goswami, pictured on the right side. And as you see, he's particularly known for his prolific writing, among other things. He and his brother, Sanatan Goswami, before they became followers of Lord Chaitanya, they were the prime minister and home minister in the government of Nawab Hussein Shah during that period of time when India in the eastern side, now West Bengal, but then like Bangladesh and West Bengal altogether, and parts of Orissa, he was the king, Nawab Hussein Shah. And they were from Saraswat Brahmin families from South India, and over a period of several generations, their family had migrated to the north, and their residence was in a place called Ramakeli. And the Nawab recognized that they were extremely qualified, not just spiritually, but also materially qualified. So qualified that everyone looked up to them as leaders who they would be willing to follow. And they were Vaishnavas, they're worshippers of Lord Vishnu or Narayan, and from their upbringing. So the Nawab approached both of them, plus their third brother, who is Anupam. There's an Anupam here, right? Yeah. And he gave them two choices. Either you assist me in my governing of this tract of land, or I'll torture all the Vaishnavas in all the land. You think about it, and let me know what you like to do. So they didn't want to do either one of them, but of the two evils, one was lesser, so they took service in the government of Nawab Hussein Shah. So at that time, prominence-wise, maybe a third to half of India, when they was prime minister, home minister, and the third brother was the finance minister. You know, big personalities with great qualifications to go along with the post that they were in. But they had no interest in any of those things. And in course of time, fast forward, they left that government service and became mendicants, followers of Lord Chaitanya, who instructed them in spiritual teachings and then sent them to Vrindavan with these two services. One was to write books according to the teachings he had given them, and the other was to reestablish the places where Krishna's pastimes had taken place in Vrindavan, because they had become lost to visible the pilgrims when they went there. There was no idea where the various places of Krishna's pastimes had occurred. So those were his assignments, and they wrote prolific and very elevated spiritual writings. And between the two of them, the younger brother, Rupa Goswami, was accepted by Lord Chaitanya as like the successor, the most elevated and most empowered members of all of his followers. And what I'm going to be describing is taken from Rupa Goswami's descriptions of the nature of relationship. But the language is the kind of language that persons that may not have read Rupa Goswami could understand. So take it very, very basic. I'm going to start with definitions. What's a relationship? And a dictionary definition, this is a common basis of interaction between two or more people. We're going to take that common basis of interaction between two or more people and unpack it in simple terms. Common basis means there is a commodity of exchange or currency all parties agree on. A commodity of exchange, that's a business term, like the commodities market. And somebody wants something, somebody's willing to pay something to get something, and that what they pay is the currency. Then the currency is something that it may be gold, or it may be something that represents gold, or it may be some other kind of a promissory note, but something that both parties agree that you give me this and I'll give you that. A currency for exchange. And both parties, or all parties, agree on that basis. And if you don't have a common basis, then there's no way to relate, or you don't have a relationship. Or what goes on a lot in this world is you have dysfunctional relationships, people that can't relate to one another. And with the term exchange implies there's a, for those of you that know Sanskrit, there's these terms ashraya and vishaya, subject and object. So without the Sanskrit term, there's a subject and object, or like in language and in grammar, the subject of a sentence and the object of the sentence, and then the conjunction verb. So that which receives action, that's the object, and that which is giving action or feeling some feeling which then promotes some action is the subject. So in a relationship, the roles vacillate. Sometimes giving, sometimes receiving. So one time one is an object, sometimes another is a subject. So just as a for example, this invisible child in the baby crib here is the object. And all the other persons huddled around the baby crib, they're the subjects. They're having some feeling towards the little child in the crib. The child is the object. They're the subject. And this alternating roles is just like in a discussion. Sometimes somebody is speaking, another party is listening. And then that party stops speaking, the other individual is speaking and they're listening. So the roles vacillate. Very simple. Very simple. Alternating roles. And what's exchanged between the two parties when there's some relationship is emotion, primarily. And when there's some emotion, then commonly there's some action that goes along with the emotion. It could just be a smile, or it could be a gesture, or it could be one's whole life is based upon that exchange of emotion. Now here comes the Rupa Goswami language part. Those of you that know his teachings will understand what I'm doing here. There's a primary emotion of love, according to these ancient writings of the Vedic wisdom. There are seven secondary emotions. And there's mixtures and subdivisions of those, but seven secondary emotions: amazement, humor, chivalry, compassion, fury, fear, and dread. When Rupa Goswami was using these terms, I'll give a little background. Lord Chaitanya was teaching him about the original relationship that we all have with God. And when we forget that original relationship that we have with God, that we try to find satisfaction in relationship with some other object besides God, like a friend or family or a dog or something, some object that replaces the original relationship with God in forgetfulness of Him. So we have relationships that go on, and within the Vedic literature, just like many of you are in the medical field, so within the Vedas there's Ayurveda, there's a science of medicine. It's the building blocks of that medicine science is different than what the universities here are teaching. But there's a system of diagnosing illness and treating illness based upon the doshas within the body, etc. So just as there's medical science, so within the Vedas there's science of relationship or science of emotion in exchange of within relationships. And then when there's different, just like when there's different mixtures of doshas, there's different symptoms of health or ill health. So similarly, when there's different mixtures of emotion, then there's different exhibitions of how one smiles, or how the eyes look, or how what the feelings are within the heart, the clenching of the fist or the opening of the hand, and so many things just based upon emotion. And it triggers behavior in different ways. So Rupa Goswami, from that science, from that portion of the Vedas, applied that science because it has as its root, there's a relationship with God. So he used that terminology to apply to relationship with Krishna. And he wrote different literatures. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is chief amongst them. And following that, Ujjwala Neelamani, describing stages of love of God in which the various personalities that have experience or are carrying love of God within their heart exhibit that love in various ways, in this primary way and then secondary ways. So here's the, amongst this primary motion of love, it has this further subdivision: neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, and conjugal love. So I will go back to describing these in just a moment. In a loving relationship, this is just review, so we're speaking the same language. The person who loves is the subject, and the person who is being loved is the object. So when we have these five kinds of love, neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental affection, and conjugal love, there's different characters that make up this, these different qualities of love. And here's a breakdown. In neutrality, let's say, we're pictured here. So here's a group of students, they're sitting in a classroom, kind of, they're there because they rolled in the same class and they don't have any relationship with one another other than they're sitting in a row in a classroom. So it's neutral or passive. But supposing somebody here drops their pen on the floor and somebody behind them says they dropped their pen on the floor, so they pick up their pen and say, "Excuse me, but you dropped your pen." They say, "Thank you. Very kind of you. Now I have my pen back." Or maybe there's an exam and the student here turns to the student here and says, "Do you know the answer for question number 5? I didn't get it." "Yeah, the answer to number 5 is..." So that's not passive anymore. It's active, where there's some service involved. So whatever is present in this situation of neutrality still exists. There's some awe or appreciation of another, but when there's active service, it moves into this category, servitude. And then supposing, you know, they not just pick up pens and share answers to exam questions, but they start to enter into some dialogue and build a relationship with one another that's not just servant and served or rendering some service, but they a confidentiality or an intimacy develops between the two, and it becomes friendship. And in course of time, supposing there's one friend, another friend, and one friend becomes so inspired in a mood of taking care of the other person that it becomes something like a senior and a junior friendship, so much so even that it's like a younger brother looking after his little brother, or like almost like a parental relationship, or parental relationship where there's a sense of maintaining another. Another is not exactly dependent, although they may be dependent as with a small child, but my relationship of love is to extend care and maintenance and see to the well-being of this other. Something perhaps like in your medical profession. And it's not exactly there's servitorship for sure, but you know, you're looking after the well-being of someone who's in a dependent position, by circumstance at least. And when one's offers everything unto the other party in conjugal love, this is according to the language of the ancient Vedic literatures, these five general categories, and there's divisions in between them. So Rupa Goswami presents this teaching. This is five different characters of love: neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parental, and conjugal love. Now, here comes something that different audiences will have some difficulty with. The other part is okay so far. But when you start saying pure and impure, then people may become a little uncomfortable. It sounds like a value judgment. What's the difference between a pure and an impure relationship? So one way to define that is when you, whether or not you really understand the other person or not. Who is the other person? What are their needs? What are their concerns? What are their interests? What's important to them? Who are they? And when that understanding of who the other person is clear, and the exchange of love is according to that understanding of the other person, then there's the possibility of a pure relationship. But the opposite is also that when we have a misunderstanding of the other person, whether it's subject or object or both, then it results in impure relationship. So that's like a hard statement to swallow. We have some statistics to indicate like this. Where do we get this wrong knowledge? Well, educational institutions help us get wrong knowledge in certain ways. If we identify with something that we're not. I'll give one example. Years ago, I was in the, living in the, we had a very large building in Manhattan, Hare Krishna Temple in Manhattan. And during Mangalarti at 4:30, one of the participants had a psychotic episode. It was a nice lady, but all of a sudden she was speaking French, screaming at the top of her lungs, and she was in the middle of a Joan of Arc revolution in France. And, you know, it took 10 strong men to subdue her because she was in a fighting spirit and fight. So we, you know, Mangalarti stopped and we took her to a little side room, and it took like 3 men just like to keep her in the room because she wanted to go out and fight the revolution. She was saying things in French that some of the devotees could understand. And, you know, we brought the called for an ambulance to come and helped her into the ambulance, and off she went. But for that period of time, she was, however it happened, perhaps some previous life and something triggered her or something, I don't know. Maybe you know from your profession or training that you're undergoing, but she thought she was somebody that she wasn't. And Prabhupada tells the story that there was in India, when he was still a householder conducting business, there was one man who committed murder. And he was brought before the judge, and on his behalf, the lawyer representing him pleaded, "My client did this in a moment of insanity." And so the judge decided that he would have a clinical evaluation to decide if the accused person was in fact clinically insane. So studies were done, and it was time for the testimony before the judge again. And the judge heard the testimony from the attorney representing the court that, "Your Honor, in my experience, everyone in this world is more or less crazy. So it's just a matter of degree." That was his testimony in the courtroom. "Because of accepting that I'm somebody that I'm not." So for our purposes, back to Rupa Goswami, for our purposes, when we think of the body to be the self, this is Bhagavad Gita chapter 2. When we think of the body to be the self, that's not who we are. We have a body, and there are things that we need to do to maintain the body and upkeep the body and repair it if it goes, has a problem. But that's not who we are. Our real identity is eternal spirit soul. Basic teaching from Bhagavad Gita. But supposing somebody doesn't have a clue about my real identity is spirit soul, and they think that I'm Napoleon Bonaparte. I'm this short guy, and I put my hand in my lapel, and I'm going to conquer all of Europe, and then the rest of the world. I just get my armies and run off into the battlefield. And clinically, that person is psychotic or crazy. It's not who they are. Once again, if we're accepting as our identity something that we're not, and then we try to enter into relationship with someone who we don't understand who they are either, then you're not going to have a very good connection. You're not going to have a strong relationship. And right knowledge is, this is now taking a spiritual or a Bhagavad Gita definition, as where we understand clearly that we're not the body, and moreover, as a spirit soul, we have an eternal relationship with God, and that eternal relationship with God is to serve Him. And when one is in that consciousness and can see another party in that consciousness, then one can have pure relationships with that individual. And where do you get this right knowledge? It comes from revealed scriptures. And just speaking in general terms, non-sectarian, transcendental spiritual teaching gives this understanding. So we can have a pure relationship that when we're in a relationship with other persons, that a result of proper understanding of their spiritual identity and not otherwise. Impure relationship is where there's ignorance of the other person's real identity. So somebody might reasonably argue, is it not possible to have pure love without all these requirements? And this presentation is saying, from the teachings of Rupa Goswami, no, it's not. When we're covered by ignorance, when we don't have an understanding of who we are and who the other person is, all of our attempts to enter into a relationship it's tainted at best, or it's impure. So someone might disagree with that and say, no, I think I can have a pure relationship even if I don't understand who I am and the other party is, in terms of spiritual conception. So here's some statistics just to help the dialogue go along. And on the topic of marriage, just in the United States alone, the last year's statistics show that there were 2,153,000 marriages. And according to statistics, 3.5 or 10%, is that right, 10%? Out of all of these marriages, 1,000 marriages ended up in divorce within 1 year. And overall, larger term statistics is 35% of new marriages are likely to end in divorce within 15 years in America. So, is it that out of these 2,153,000 people that got married, their idea was, hey, I got a great idea. Let's get married, and then within 1 year we'll get a divorce. Yeah, that's a great idea. I think that's a great plan. Let's do that. That's not how it starts out, but something happens over a period of time. And now with abortion, last year's statistics in the United States, 4,309,000 live births, but a corresponding almost 1 million spontaneous abortions, and it's run off the page, but 1.197 million procured abortions. So 28 abortions for every 100 live births. So let's take a similar scenario. Now we're married. I got a great idea. Let's produce a child, but before the child is born, let's abort the child. That would be a nice program. Let's do that. That's not where it starts, but somewhere along the line, something happens. And even if you take aside, okay, there may be some assaults and rape, and because of the rape, then there's some child that's conceived, and so remove that statistic, and still, that's not where the majority of abortions come from. And even if it's extramarital relationship between boyfriend, girlfriend, and so on, because we don't want the result of our having produced a child, and so there's an impurity factor here, or crime, big number, 1.4 million crimes in the United States last year, or an average 3,858 every day in the United States. So let's have the guy got a nice idea. Let's have a community, and let's make a bunch of crime against one another. It's not how it starts out. When relationships begin, it's not with this kind of idea. Look at the amounts of crime against property. Almost 10 million in 1 year, or 26,000 plus, 27,000 daily. On college campuses, I visit college campuses a lot, and this data is taken directly from big, broad bulletin boards. Relationship violence, that's their term. I'll read. All forms of relationship violence are prevalent among male and female college students. Almost half of students have experienced relationship violence at some point in their lives. More than one-third had experienced violence before college, and one-quarter had experienced violence during college. So, certainly there may be predatorial type of people, that's their thing. They want to get into a relationship and make violence upon another person. But that's not the majority of where relationship violence comes from. It's people that get together, and something happens when they become very close to one another, and some acts of violence take place. Large number, look at that percentage, half of the college students interviewed had relationship violence. It's not like where you begin with in having a relationship with people. but it happens. So there are statistics that indicate there are impure relationships, and there is an alternative, pure relationships. So where there's an exchange of love, this is the premise, and I'll be open for hearing other points of view than this premise. But the exchange of love between one temporary limited body and another temporary limited body ends in temporary limited love. And conversely, when there's an exchange of love between one eternal, powerful soul and another eternal, powerful soul, it results in lasting, powerful relationships. So we're almost done, but there's a very important component that's required to complete this, and that is the inclusion of God. When we have a relationship between one person and another person, where does God fit into the picture? Someone might say, you don't need God to fit into the picture. You can have pure relationships without God. But the Vedic wisdom teaches us otherwise, and that's because God actually exists. Fundamentally, one living being and another living being exist, and the relationship exists. Their capacities to do anything exist because of the existence of God. And that has to be factored into all categories of relationships. So how does it work? Well, it works where person A recognizes I'm part and parcel of the Supreme God, and party B, you're also part and parcel of the Supreme God. Now, let us honor our common relationship with one another by recognizing that there's a common object, and that's God. So in our relationship with one another, we're conducting our activities for the satisfaction and pleasure ultimately of God. Here's the Bhagavat way of expressing this. One achieves complete satisfaction in any activity or any relationship when we're serving God. It's just like watering the root of a tree, and automatically all the parts, leaves, branches, fruits, flowers, twigs, everything, parts of the tree are benefited by watering the tree. Or when God is at the center, there are those persons who are guiding us spiritually and our immediate family members and extended family and society. But if you have God at the center, then you have healthy relationships. I was invited December 2 years ago. I was in Detroit, Michigan at the Fisher Mansion, the temple there. And it wasn't planned, but there was a gentleman in the area from Sri Lanka who had a spiritual society, and he was making a tour in America, and he was presenting this one piece dialogue with people in America to try to promote world peace. So I was invited to be a speaker along with this individual. So this is what I spoke about, and I spoke about the first lecture that I heard Srila Prabhupada speak. And when I was very new, very young, and Prabhupada had also recently come to America, newly, I couldn't understand his accent. So I had to listen to the class again and again and finally get it. But because I listened to it again and again, it was the first lecture, it made like a very deep impression. And here's what Prabhupada said. He made a motion like this with his hands and said, imagine there's a big pond right in the middle of the floor here. And we gave each person in the room a small stone, a pebble. And we said, take your stone and throw it in the middle of the pond, and what will happen? So a little splash like this, and concentric circles expand, and it's very nice. And then somebody else, you take your stone and put it into the pond and see what happens. And same thing happens. And it's all very nice until the concentric circles intersect with one another, and then there's clash. And then he said, supposing everybody else all at once throws your stone into the pond at the same time, what will happen? The splash will be there, but it's the surface of the water will be chaos. But then supposing instead we all agree on a common point, and we all place our pebble or stone on that same common point, and what happens? There's no clash, and in fact, the concentric circles amplify one another. So his point was, in this way, one can preserve individuality, but at the same time, not create disharmony by acting in this world, by placing one's individual service or loving propensity upon God. And automatically the other individuals similarly doing the same creates for a very harmonious result in the world. So I want to now a little anecdotal deviation. In modern context, there's a reviving of interest in spiritual communes. I don't know if any of you have picked up on that. Maybe because of your academic studies, it's not like on your radar screen very much. But in the West, particularly in America, but America and Europe, there's a growing interest in spirituality, and there's a growing interest in the sharing and, you know, taking the resources of nature and using them in a sustainable and responsible and spiritual communities that have that as at the center. It's becoming very attractive. So when I was going to college, that was also a very attractive thing. There were communes that were springing up all over the place. So when I, about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago, I was in New York City, and I was invited to take part in a program at Penn State University. So, and before going to Penn State, I was going to stop at our farm in mid-Pennsylvania, a place called Gitanagari, just north of Harrisburg. So I was on a train going from New York City heading for Harrisburg. And the train pulled into Philadelphia, South Street Station. A lot of people got out, some more people got on. So I was just sitting there doing my thing. And the train filled up. So I was on an aisle seat, and right next to me was another seat. And a lady asked, "Is anybody seating there?" And I said, "No, fine, you can sit." So she sat, and I was dressed like I'm dressed, and she had a Harinam chadar around her shoulders. So I kind of put two and two together quickly. She had some kind of interaction with India. And she was being very polite to not, like, interrupt what I was doing, but she was a talkative type, and she couldn't help herself, so she had to, you know, ask, are you part of a religious organization? I said, yes. He said, are you part of an ashram? I said, oh, she knows the word ashram. I said, yes. And how about you? She said, oh, I used to live in an ashram. I said, really? Where was that ashram? She said, West Virginia. And some of you know that we have a large community in West Virginia. I thought, wow, maybe she was part of the New Vrindavan community in West Virginia. I said, where in West Virginia? She said, she didn't say Moundsville, she gave some other place. And I said, what was the nature of that? So the discussion went on. What was the nature of that community? Or commune? She said, well, it was a group of people that had these ideals about agriculture, and we all got together. And then what happened? Well, it lasted for about a year and a half, and you know how it goes. They had dissension. That which brought unity later on, some wanted to do it this way, some wanted to do it that way. And so the commune started to break apart, and I left. I said, so what did you do then? I went to New York and joined another ashram. In New York City, another ashram? She said, yeah, it was a yoga ashram. Oh, okay. And then what happened? Oh, I did that for a while, and And I'm still practicing yoga, but I moved back to Philadelphia where I came from. Okay. And then she said, what about your ashram? I said, well, here's a distinction. Because around the same time that you were these two different ashrams, one of them that doesn't exist anymore, there was an ashram also in West Virginia. And it still exists. And there's a reason why it still exists, and it's flourishing. And it's because God was in the center. And, you know, teachings that are derived from the ancient Vedic wisdom were the guiding that community in how to worship God, how to worship Krishna. And, in fact, the place that I'm going is a similar community. It's in mid-Pennsylvania. I said, oh, I'd like to go. How would I get there? So I gave her the contact information. I have to spend time with my friend, but I'd like to go. So here's where there's God-centered relationships amongst groups of people that then have durability. But when you don't have God in the center, then naturally conflicts are inevitable. You have two different wills, two different ideas, two different ways of doing maybe even the same thing, and you have a conflict. So that's not what we want. We want this one. We want God-centered relationships. That's ideal. And when God-centered relationships exist, then there's purity in the relationship, and that will sustain. It's not a matter of this religion, that religion. It's a principle that regardless of what ism or doctrine or teachings one holds, if you have these basic components, you can have pure relationship. One is that our identity is soul, not this body. And the body is a dress of the soul, and God is the Supreme Person. And as the Supreme Person, He creates everything. Because He creates everything, there's this natural relationship that He is the master and we're the servant. Now we can have relationships with one another with that common acknowledgement that God is the one that we're serving, and we're assisting one another, sharing that experience of serving God together. So this is a little summary of both Rupa Goswami's teachings and the teachings of Bhagavad Gita that are aimed at helping us overcome the barriers that prevent pure relationships and to come a little closer in that direction, at least in principle. And the last part is this prayer or a little saying that Mother Teresa kept on her wall in Calcutta. And the punchline is down here, but how this came to my attention was there's a marriage counselor, a devotee, and she was sharing, I was appreciating, you've done magic with this nice couple, nice husband, nice wife, but they were having a problem in their relationship with one another, and somehow it's like taken care of. And she said, what I did was, I just explained this last line of Mother Teresa's writing, that the real issue in any relationship is, what is our relationship with God? And that's what's important. And if one can acknowledge that importance, that's what's the essence in any case. So I'll read, it's nice. People are often unreasonable, irrational, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you'll win some unfaithful friends and some genuine enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and sincere, people may deceive you. Be honest and sincere anyway. What you spend years creating, others could destroy overnight. Create anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, some may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten. Do good anyway. Give the best you have, and it will never be enough give your best anyway. In the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. So she shared with me, this marriage counselor, that this one saying, you know, if an individual can be clear about what's really the most important thing is their relationship with God, and because of their relationship with God, they can serve another selflessly, because it's about service to God. This or that or the other thing is suspended by this one higher principle, it's service to God. Then you can easily be forgiving and so forth and so on. You can be decorated with very good qualities because you're doing service to God. Here's the last. This is put together by a nice devotee that knows how to do these things. Little video. Thank you. Krishna. That's it. Okay. The light can come back on. Fantastic. I was asked to follow it. I don't know exactly how to do this. After this, to something Tulsi Vivaha and something Damodar Month. The Damodar Month is easy because the Leela is Mother Jasoda's love for Damodar. And although she tried to bind her son out of maternal affection, she was unable to bind him because he's the Supreme Lord and he didn't want to be bound. But he yielded to the intensity of her love and was bound by her love. So even the Supreme Lord, when one's loving capacity becomes like Mother Jasoda, can bring Damodar, the Supreme Person, into a position of loving subordination to his own devotee. Nice Leela. Maybe I'll discuss that this evening at the temple. Shout Center, is that appropriate? It's the last day of Damodar month. Okay. What's your some thought? On this or the Sunday program? Okay. So any comments or discussion?
Yeah. Question. Yeah. You know, in Indian culture, like parents invest on you a lot of things, like they sacrifice for you everything. Like our parents, they sacrifice the same for us, for our education, everything.
It's not only in India. I think it's universal.
I mean, I'm wrong, but I can tell about my culture, like my country, so.
Okay, it's all over the world, I'm telling you.
So they have high expectations from our side also, like to perform good in career-wise and also to rise high.
I've noticed.
So, the thing is, like, when we realize that, from our discussion, like, we realize that God should be the final goal should be to go near to the God. So, and then there are some expectations from parents, like they are also pulling you to.
It's not in conflict. One is not in conflict with the other, or need not be in conflict with the other. So we all have parents. That's something we all have in common. And our parents have made great sacrifices for all of us. So it's a universal, not just India or not just Hindu culture, it's a universal principle. Honor your parents. Universal. So now how does that fit in with God consciousness? Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, text 66. Sarvadharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishami ma shuchah. But Krishna doesn't say, forget your parents, Arjuna, forget it. Trash it. Just me. That's not what Krishna says. But any principle of Dharma, which is given by God, and therefore it's a principle of Dharma, Dharmam Sakshat Bhagavat Pranitam. Dharma is given by Bhagavan. So the principles of Dharma that are universal, including respecting one's parents, they're to be seen in terms of the ultimate principle which that principle is meant to serve. And that one principle that all principles are meant to serve is Mam Ekam Sharanam. So let the service or respect to one's parents be in pursuance of, or in connection with, or in fulfillment of our surrender to the personality of Godhead. Here's a visual. I'm a visual person. Part of me is a visual person. So, supposing you have a big chandelier, and it's beautiful crystals, beautiful shape, sparkling, but it's useless unless it's suspended. So that point that suspends that big, beautiful chandelier is the principal thing under which, beneath which, all of the parts of that chandelier are suspended. So whatever principle of Dharma exists, it's suspended by one principle. It's subordinate to one principle. And you leave aside that one principle, the efficacy is lost. The real purpose behind all principles of Dharma is lost, because they're meant to bring one to that position. You take that position, it doesn't mean you abandon. When Krishna, they're subordinate to, they're to be pursued in pursuance of, or in subordination to this higher principle. And if there's a conflict, what takes precedence is the primary principle. That's the rule of Dharma. When the Yaksha comes out of the lake and questions Yamaraj about Dharma, very complex subject, and very tricky questions. And one of his questions is that one, that at times there's conflicts of Dharma. This is a Dharma, and that's a Dharma, and they cancel one another out. So what do you do? How are you to decide? Yudhisthira says, it's true, it's very difficult. And therefore one should follow the Mahajans. Mahajano yena katasa panta. And life is like that. Dharma is like that, and life is like that. There are principles that are values that we hold, and sometimes one value is in conflict with another value. We value a relationship with a dear friend, and that friend is in conflict with another dear friend or a family member. And what do you do? Because you don't want to take sides. And then one side or the other side will be hurt. But you have to do something. What do you do? The light isn't clear until it's the principle, the primary principle, is connected with. That's how Dharma is determined. And it's conflicting sometimes which principle is superior to another principle. But this principle is above all other principles. Mam ekam sharanam. And aham tvam sarva papebhyo. If you think by adhering to that principle, you may make some transgression. Krishna explains there's no sinful reaction when you hold that principle. And just in case you have some doubt, don't have any doubt. Mahasuchaha. Life is complex, Dharma is complex, duty is complex. But hold this one principle above all other principles, and there's light to see your way through complexity. And without it, it's very confusing. Anything?
Sorry, I missed up. What was the principle where Dharma hinges from?
From making your connection with God and loving God. So that which achieves or brings happiness and pleasure to God, that's primary. Anything else is pursuant to that one. Honoring your parents, following the laws of the state, you know, keep to the right, pay your taxes, you know, treat other people with kindness and courtesy, extend compassion, Whatever principle is a principle of virtue or right action. It's subordinate to that one higher principle. That which gives is meant for pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead and acting in our loving relationship with Him. All of the principles are subordinate to that one. Yes.
What are the ways to identify a pure soul to connect with for a pure relationship?
Well, that's a nice question. Arjuna asked that question several times in different ways in Bhagavad Gita. What are the symptoms of a self-realized soul? Or by what means can one achieve the state? We are beyond the modes of nature and so on. So there are characteristics or qualities. I can identify some of them. Let's take a nice list as chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita, texts 8 through 12. It's a list of qualities, but in this list of qualities, it's items of knowledge. Well, where it starts is amanitvam, adambitvam, humility and pridelessness. That's a good start. And, you know, not circumstantial, but consistent. I'll give this something that's coming to mind is in Your Ever Well Wisher. It's a documentary that Yadubar Prabhu made of Srila Prabhupada, and he's interviewing a industrialist from Bombay who later became Prabhupada's disciple. But Srinathji said when he met Srila Prabhupada, he says it explicitly in an interview, "I did what any businessman does. I tried to find the weak spot of the other person. So I tested him. Maybe he's greedy. Maybe he's proud. Maybe he's this. What's his weak spot?" And I tried all these different things, and I found he has no weak spot. And then I could understand he's coming from a place of purity. Now, we don't necessarily have to take the same way as, you know, literally testing a person, but you can see by their quality. Are they genuinely, not just in name, but genuinely attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So some of the symptoms that are mentioned in Bhagavad Gita specifically is neutral to opposites of duality. They're neither, you know, overjoyed when success comes, or unhappy when failure comes, or honor and dishonor, the equal, and honor and dishonor, happiness and distress, pleasure and pain, equal. So that it means, you know, that person is on a transcendental position, and their standard or their sense of happiness is not based upon a material configuration of matter. It's another position, another place. Their shelter is the Personality of Godhead. So it's a symptom. They're neutral towards diversities. Many other things. They have the natural qualities of goodness are consistent. Again, not circumstantial.
Well,
I'll give you a yeah, but answer. Yes, but there are different ideas that different people have of what selflessness is. The Bhagavat definition of selflessness is where the Personality of Godhead is at the center. He is to be pleased, and there's nothing material that can create that act of service to the Supreme. There's nothing material that can check that act of service to the Supreme. I'm speaking like that because I have experience with persons that are proud of their selfless work, and if that selfless work isn't honored, they become angry. I could tell a whole story about that one. It was a you know, awakening. Doing wonderful work, but if not recognized, ooh. So, and then another component of selflessness is on the platform of the soul. Because one can do some selfless work that's on the platform of the body and be in the, like this presentation, have a misconception of who I am, who the other person is, and what selflessness is. So that means that there's some other perk that's wanted, because we all have the experience of what doing something for another person, not because you have to, but just because it's the right thing to do. And that happiness in the mode of goodness, we all know what that happiness is. And it's not selflessness. It's, I'm deriving some happiness from some sense of well-being and contentedness from that act. And real selflessness doesn't have that. It's another thing altogether. It may include an act of kindness, but the place from which it's coming is something else, if it's truly transcendental or truly selfless. It's service to the Supreme, regardless of what I feel or don't feel, or the austerity that's involved, or the absence of austerity that's involved. It's just, it's service unto the Supreme. That's the standard of real selflessness. Yes?
Suppose I release my relationship with God.
What's next? Serve Him eternally. And invite others to participate similarly. And the best way to invite others is by your example. By your own qualities. They'll be so inviting. Persons will want to, hey, this is very nice. I don't know what it is that you're doing, but it's making you very happy. Anyone else?
I like this one statement of Einstein that was saying that any significant problem that you have to solve, you can't keep thinking in the same way that you kept when you solved it.
Yeah, the state of consciousness that you're in when you created the problem. Spiritual solutions to material problems enables the material problems to be ultimately resolved.
One more quote he says that, I'm not a genius, but I stay with the problem no longer than this. I stay with the problem no longer than this.
Stayed with it?
Stay with the problem. To solve it.
Okay. Everyone's either tired or satisfied or hungry or... Huh? Hungry. Okay. Are we ready in the prasadam department?
Actually, I also told them we will have Tulsi Puja and Damodarastakam.
Tulsi Puja and Damodarastakam. And where is that going to take place?
Right
here.
Yeah. We can stand up.
Okay. Do you have something in relation to Tulsi in mind for this evening? Okay. Let me say something before we do Tulsi Puja and in honor of Tulsi Vivaha. Please excuse me if this, like, offends anybody, but there's a pure and there's an impure rendering of Tulsi Vivaha, one of the tamasic narrations of Tulsi Vivaha is Lord Vishnu violated the chastity of Tulsi, and so he was cursed and he became Shalagram. Lord Vishnu, even to speak those words, it makes me very uncomfortable. Or rather, in our literature of, you saw the picture of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami, they wrote many wonderful literatures, and one of those literatures describes Tulsi Vivaha. Tulsi, in her expanded form in Krishna's Leela, is Vrinda Devi. So there was a wonderful Leela in which Vrinda Devi, and along with the other gopis, there was this idea, a child play, in which the girls were saying, Vrinda Devi, this is Vrindavan, and the whole of Vrindavan belongs to Vrinda Devi. Wouldn't it be very nice if Vrinda and Krishna became married? So they were little children saying, oh, this is a wonderful idea. So they had a mock marriage. And they were doing all the things involved in a marriage. It's a detailed description in Rupa Goswami's writing. And it got down to where the cloth of Vrinda Devi and the cloth of Krishna were tied together. And it suddenly occurred to Vrinda Devi, wait a minute, this is the same thing that happens when somebody is married. And she panicked, and she stood up and tried to run, but she couldn't run because her cloth was tied to Krishna's cloth. And the gopis were clapping and laughing and smiling, and Vrinda Devi was panicking. Let me out of here. This isn't right. Krishna alone should be married to Radharani. And this is just a mock marriage, but supposing somebody tells that this happened and they'll think that we're married. And she was very unhappy. But that's our Goswami rendering of this honoring of this day. Krishna and Vrinda Devi, or Tulsi Devi, become married. In our Vaishnava practice, Vrinda Devi is, we have our, every day, we'll have just in a moment, Tulsi Puja. We have these beautiful prayers that describe Tulsi as the giver of devotion. She bestows devotion upon those who, and devotion to Krishna upon those who approach Tulsi Devi. So, we're going to have Tulsi Puja, I guess. You have a Tulsi plant here? Okay. And in the prayers that we're going to sing, they're in Bengali, but the prayers that we sing, the translation of them is, we're praying to Vrinda Devi to make us, bestow your mercy upon us, make us eternal residents in Vrindavan Dham, in the land of Krishna, and bestow upon us this benediction of love for Krishna by your mercy. So we're honoring Vrinda Devi in the program and for this day of Tulsi Vivaha. Hare Krishna.